Hello, and welcome to the 8th edition of Chicago Business Podcast. It is with some reservation that I bring you this episode today, but I think it's important to try to return some normalcy to life as we know it out there, given the events over the last week. I know it's important for me and my family. Certainly. So I am Drew Sekula, your host of Chicago Business Podcast. Today, we welcome Gus Noble, the president of Chicago Scots and Caledonia Senior Living, which is the oldest nonprofit organization in the state of Illinois, dating back some 175 years. So they have a great story to tell. Very interesting to hear what all they're doing to support our most vulnerable population during this time of COVID-19. I know there's a lot else going on in the world and certainly in the States today, but this is an important story that I want to get out there. So thank you for joining and enjoy the show. Thank you. Hello and welcome to another edition of Chicago Business Podcast. I am your host, Drew Sekula, and today we welcome Gus Noble, president of Chicago Scots and Caledonia Senior Living, which includes the oldest nonprofit organization in the state of Illinois, dating back some 175 years. So welcome, Gus. Great to have you on.
Thank you, Drew. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you. So maybe we can start, Gus, if you could just tell us a little bit, you know, what is Chicago Scots?
As you said, Drew, we're the oldest 501c3 charity in Illinois. We've been around since the 1st of December, 1845. Chicago's population was just 12,000 people when a bunch of Scots got together, as they did all over the world, and said, we must do something to celebrate the culture of Scotland in the new land we've come to. But what made those Scots in Chicago unique is that when they got together, they said, yes, we'll celebrate culture, but we must also do something of service to those of our fellow country people who struggle to adapt to life after moving from the old country to the new country. And so they resolved on the 1st of December, 1845, that they would form a St. Andrew Society. And that St. Andrew Society was set off in a really visionary way by this group of Scots with a mission. They committed to a written mission statement in the year 1845, and that was to ensure that no deserving Scot in need would go without food, shelter, medical attention, or be buried in a potter's field. Well, 175 years later, we're still driven by a mission of culture and care. And where they come together, you have this unique blend of an organization that delivers life's most important things, which are especially true in this time of pandemic and crisis. Those things are home, family, and love. And of course, we enjoy a good whiskey as we do those things.
That's a great segue for us to you know, as you're aware, here on the Chicago Business Podcast, we like to have our guests choose a beverage to enjoy. And this early evening, I think you have one to introduce to us. So why don't you tell us what we're having?
I do. Tonight, it's a special whiskey from Scotland called Talisker. And in the year of the Society's 160th anniversary, 15 years ago, I made an arrangement with Talisker and their local representative at the time, a guy called Marty Duffy, who is still around Chicago, great guy, and he actually produced this whiskey glass from Glencairn that we've poured the Talisker into. The Talisker had a special whiskey called their 175th anniversary. And how coincidental we are in our 175th talking about this. But that happened to be the year of the Chicago Scots 160th anniversary. So I said to Marty, can I buy an allotment of bottles. How many do you have coming to Illinois? And lo and behold, Illinois' allotment was 160 bottles. So I bought the whole lot, or rather the society bought the whole lot. And since then, we've been giving them away or selling them at very special occasions for the celebration of our 175th. So one of 162, of 163, of 160, and so on, sound by the master distiller and myself. And I thought tonight's a good occasion to pour one and enjoy one. So Svajavar.
Wow, nice. Yes, I will join you with some scotch, but not nearly of the same quality. So I have a 12-year Glenlivet here, which is what I had in my little bar. So it's not the same, and it's not neat either. I have mine on the rocks, but you're the aficionado. I'm the novice of the group.
To each his or her own. It's how you like it.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's great. Thanks for bringing that beverage of the day. That's great. So, if you could give us, so we've talked a little bit about the broader mission of Chicago Scots, and it's great to hear about that. I know that, just from a cultural perspective, it's funny. There's one gentleman that I'm reminded of that I used to work with back in San Jose, California, Clive Feeder, who was a Scot. And, it seems like you guys share some of the wit, and I don't know. We haven't seen it quite yet, but I have a sense of sarcasm as well that seems to come through in the with the old Scots. So
it's so compulsory. Sarcasm's compulsory for growing up safe in Scotland.
Is that right? Yeah.
The organization, it's a wonderful blend of, as I said, culture and care. Our principal charitable mission is Caledonia Senior Living, which itself is more than 100 years old, 7 miles west of downtown Chicago, a beautiful little retirement community. We care for the most vulnerable of our Illinoisans at the moment. Of course, with COVID-19 being part of our lives, we have a mission to protect the health and safety of the people who live and work at Caledonia Senior Living. And we take that mission really, really seriously. You may hear some bagpipes in the background. There's a local dance group who have a dance studio here in our nursing home. And pre-COVID-19, the dancers would come at least once or twice a week and rehearse. And through these evening rehearsals, they develop friendships with the residents. Well, of course, when this crisis hit, this community went into a pretty advanced state of lockdown, meaning that visitors were no longer prohibited, including, in a heartbreaking way, our families. They can't come and visit their loved ones until such a time that we all feel it's safe to open up a bit. We put down some fairly extreme measures. Residents are sheltering in their own rooms. We really scaled back on communal dining, and activities are all done at a physical distance of more than 6 feet. Many of the activities we can now take outdoors, that the Chicago summer has arrived, and space exercise classes and trivia classes, trivia games in a safe way. But the dancers have never forgotten the residents. And so the first week of the crisis, when we went into lockdown, bit like Tuesdays with Maury, it's Tuesdays with the dancers. And they show up with a bagpiper and have done every week of this crisis. And outside the resident windows, they'll perform Highland dances and reels and jigs and all sorts of colorful dances. And they go around all the community and dance in our central courtyards, outside resident windows, in our gardens. And it's such a heartwarming thing to hear the sound of the pipes and to look out the windows and see the dancers there reconnecting, despite the restrictions we have in place, with their friends. In a similar way, we have our residents' families come and they'll sit outside the residents' windows and bring a picnic for lunch or for dinner, or in the colder temperature weather, they were bringing flasks of coffee and soup to keep warm. And they'd sit at a distance of 15 feet or so from the residence window and have a conversation and connect. So despite those pretty steep and stiff measures of precaution and restriction that we have in place, we still managed to deliver those things. And I'll say them again because they bear repeating: home, family, and love. So we do whatever we can to take care of people who live and work here. But we have a cultural mission also, and the dancers are part of that cultural mission, but it too has been impacted by COVID-19. We host an annual summer festival, the big Highland Games and Scottish Festival, where we had, for the last couple of years, the world record caber tosser and heavy athlete. This guy's incredible. They call him the Michael Jordan of the sport, because for the first time in history, and it's a long history, one person has held concurrently five world records in nine of the events that comprise heavy athletics. He's an incredible athlete. We also had the largest bagpiping and drumming championship in all of North America. And at the end of the day, at this long festival where there are whiskey tasting and Celtic rock and rugby tournaments and kids areas, there's food you can eat from Scotland, there's all manner of goods you can buy at a Celtic marketplace befitted for a kilt. There's an incredible array of different things. Everybody repairs to the field at the end of the day where the event comes to a close and listens to all these pipe bands. There were over 1,000 musicians playing in unison, drummers and pipers. And the noise was incredible. They'd play the first strains of Amazing Grace, one lone bagpiper off in the distance, and then 1,000 bagpipers and drummers would join in. And the incredible thing was, I look around and I see a grandfather and a grandson kind of hold hands and look at one another, and wordlessly they communicate something of pride that's impossible to put into words, that there's this wonderful connection of love across generations. And that's what this organization does, whether it's at the Scottish Home, the McLean House, which is where we take care of people living with Alzheimer's, or at one of our many cultural events. We deliver feelings of Scotland, of home, of family, of kith and kin, and of love between the community.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, just compared to other, you know, potential solutions that families, you know, are faced with and try to figure out when, you know, when they have family members that are, you know, getting up there of age and need some additional care, it seems like you guys really take it above and beyond in terms of maintaining those connections to culture and to family. And those are inspiring stories and something to really hold true. So that's great that you've been able to, you know, continue as much as possible with that, considering the current pandemic. Doing a little reading, it sounds like you guys have fared better than most in terms of, you know, you're in a precarious spot in terms of the kind of the population that you serve there, but it sounds like that you guys have done well, knock on wood anyway, with in terms of the incidents that you've had and your ability to navigate through the crisis.
Yeah, there are a few reasons for that. And I appreciate you saying that, Drew. We're very proud of this community and our team. As I say to them when we meet once a week, there are three reasons that we've managed to, so far, keep COVID-19 from our doors: luck, the grace of God, and the vigilance of our staff. And I can't thank them or tell you how proud I am to stand with them. Our teams are doing incredible things behind the locked doors of this community. For the first time in over 100 years, we've had to lock our front doors because of this coronavirus. And what I see when I come behind those doors every day are incredible people stepping up and making sure that residents and their colleagues are comfortable or comforted. and that they have all they need to do the jobs as we go into this crisis. We're also a small community. And I think as you look at communal living, as we've heard the governor and Dr. Azike say in their press briefings, large congregate settings are the ones that are really vulnerable to the spread and to continuing exposure of this virus. It is totally non-discriminatory. It's an equal opportunity infector. So the smaller community may have an advantage in that we can go into lockdown and be more nimble and contain the virus in a way that protect, in our case, from the virus. We also don't have rehab beds or temporary stays or independent living who are out in the community as much. While they are the frail of our grandparents and parents and our loved ones, they are also in a community that I think is well suited to offer a layer or a degree of protection to them. And I'm so proud of what we've managed to accomplish so far, but we are by no means through it. It's not time to lift the restrictions here. We have to find ways to deliver meaning and love and home and family in the context of those restrictions. So we take advantage of window time or of technologies like the one we're using now, Zoom. For Mother's Day, we connected via FaceTime and various other tools, families with their loved ones here. And we're also using a new AV, an in-house TV system that a very kind donor helped us to install to run bingo games. So the first time we did it, there was a famous Nick Gelfis, a famous actor from Chicago Fire. He called bingo for us, and he was beamed in through our in-house TV system, and residents in their rooms each had a whistle or a rattle or some type of noisemaker. And those of us who were on staff were stationed in the corridors with our walkie-talkies.
You can take a step back, Gus, and you can tell us about your origin story. We've been talking a lot about Chicago Scots and what you're doing there with the assisted living facility there with Caledonia. But we'd like to learn a little bit more about you as well. So what's your background and how did you get, how have you found yourself in the position you're in today?
I have figured out that about 3 years ago, I woke up one morning and I said, you know, I wonder how long I've lived in Chicago, having moved here on the 16th of November, 1992, from Scotland. And I figured out that in March 2017, I spent more of my life living here than I ever did in Scotland. And that was kind of a trip. I thought, wow, what does that mean for my own identity? You know, who am I now? And where do I belong? And at the time, I was a brand new father of a beautiful baby boy called Bobby. My wife, Aisha, and I were very proud when Bobby was born, and also very proud when our second son, Langston, was born last year. But I thought to myself, you know, if I've lived here for more of my life than I lived in Scotland, I owe it to myself, I owe it to my wife, and most of all, I owe it to my family, my son, if I should become an American. So in April 2018, I went down to pledge my allegiance to the United States of America and become an American citizen. And it was it was almost the most moving experience of my life. I should say the birth of my sons was, and of course my marriage to my beautiful wife. But it was an incredibly moving experience. Here's what happened. When you go into the Center for Citizenship, there is a large room where everybody waiting to become an American citizen is seating in order. And by the way, there were about 150 of us, and we came from north of 50 countries. It was incredible the amount of representation from all around the world was there. But next to this group of seats was another group of seats that were for the friends, the families, the loved ones of people who were being naturalized. And at the back of the room, there are windows looking out over Congress. They're ceiling to floor windows. Light was streaming in. It was a very bright scene. And on the floor was a map, a huge rug with a map of the United States of America on it. And each state was represented by a different vivid color. Light streaming on, color sparkling everywhere. And as I looked, the kids of all the people who, like me, were waiting to become Americans were dancing and playing on this rug. And their skin and their hair and their personalities were as different and varied as the rug below their feet. And I looked, and one of them was my son. And at that moment, as soon as I saw my son, they called my name, and I stood up to go and pledge my oath of allegiance. And as I'm walking up, I thought, what more powerful sight can I see than kids playing on the land that is the home to which I pledge my allegiance now? So I'm very much a Scottish American. I'm proud to be so. In fact, I'm a Chicago Scot. We as Chicago Scots welcome everyone who is Scottish by birth, by heritage, or simply by inclination.
Nice. Yeah, that's a nice way to do it. I saw that you that you have a pretty diverse family there, as to many in my family. We have all sorts of races and creeds in my extended family. So what has that experience been like for you? I mean, you talked a little bit going through the naturalization process, but, you know, Chicago is certainly known as a melting pot. And has that been your experience, that you've really felt welcome here? And coming in, you know, immigration being, you know, so much of a topic, and what's your perspective on some of those topics?
Well, Chicago is home for me now. I feel as Chicagoan as you know, I would never dream of putting ketchup on a hot dog. Let me put it that way, or whiskey on haggis, which I've seen people do here. So the Scot in me still kind of balks at putting whiskey on haggis. I felt something very powerful about Chicago from an early age, before I ever moved here. There was a pull that Chicago, I felt Chicago pull me. When I was probably about 16, my uncle gave me his record collection. And in it, there were some records by Muddy Waters and Little Walter and Howlin' Wolf and all the great chess records that Chicago has become known for. And as soon as I heard these guys play, something in my gut, something kind of primal was shifted. And I just felt this pull of Chicago. And so it's always been my intention to visit. When I graduated university, I decided to come over and visit a couple of people that I'd met when I was working in Scotland. And I ended up going into the British consulate when it was located on Dearborn. And I'd come here after having played Chicago blues in a band in Scotland. That was my passion. By day, I'm a professional Scotsman that runs a retirement community. By night, I'm a bass player and continue to be so. But in those days, I did a lot of playing Chicago blues, including at this little club in St. Andrews. So back in Chicago, I walk into the British consulate on Dearborn to see if there was a pub in Chicago that would show a soccer match from back home. I began to really miss soccer. And the man who was working in the consulate behind the bulletproof glass of the visa section said to me, "You look very familiar." And I said, I can't, you know, it's impossible. I've just arrived in Chicago. And he says, you're from Scotland. Yes, I'm from Scotland. And he said, did you ever spend any time in St. Andrews? And I said, well, I played in a band in Scotland, and we used to have a regular gig at a place called the Victoria Cafe. And John slapped the counter and he said, I was a regular at the Vic and I saw your band play there. What are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm just visiting. And he said, let's go for lunch. So he took me to the Berghoff, and over a beer and a roast beef sandwich, offered me a job. And that afternoon, I marched back up Dearborn Avenue, and he gave me a pile of British passports, and he said, start stamping those. And a few years later, I got a job as the management officer, and subsequently became the vice consul for press, commercial publicity and press, and helped tell the stories of British companies and British industry in the American trade press. Following devolution in the UK, I was offered a job working for the government of Wales, running their economic development operations in the United States. And then in 2004, I was lucky enough to be invited to be interview for the job I have now. And 16 years later, here I am talking to Drew and drinking a very good whiskey.
There you are. No, that's quite the story. It's interesting how, you know, in the world being as big as it is, those micro interactions are, you know, what makes the difference. And
incredible. But you talked about Chicago being a melting pot. We certainly are, and I think that's a really important thing to recognize. You know, we have, of course, a mission to celebrate and to nourish Scottish identity, to celebrate our culture, but to really make a culture evolve and be resilient through the generations and be relevant through the generations, it has to be defined as a welcoming culture. And that's why I say that the Chicago Scots welcome everyone who's Scottish by birth, by heritage, or simply by inclination. If you're fond of good whiskey, or Sean Connery, or the Ryder Cup, you know, golf is Scotland's greatest gift and curse on the world, depending on which way you look at it, then you're welcome as part of our community. And I felt the same sense from Chicago. I felt that I was immediately taken in and felt instantly connected to the culture and identity of the city in a way that feels stronger than ever all these years later.
Nice. How often do you make it back to the home country?
I had been going every year. I don't know when the next time I'm going to go is because of COVID-19. But my parents are still there. My sister is still in Edinburgh. My parents are in the Scottish Borders. I took my son Bobby back last year for a friend's wedding, and it was a few months after Langston was born. And I thought it was a time for Daddy to take son number one on a bonding trip. He felt that there was a new kid in town, and it was time that we had to spoil him a little. So he became king of the castle with grandparents and cousins and so on. So that was a great trip back last year, and we got to play a little golf and go and visit some of my favourite places in Scotland, south of Edinburgh, over to Glasgow, a place called North Berwick, which is where I used to spend my summer holidays, and went over to the Scottish Seabird Centre and played some incredible golf, as I say. So that was a special trip, but I'm not sure when we're going to go back next.
Right. Yeah, I don't think anybody can see that far in the future, I guess. Well, hopefully it's not too far, but you never know when these travel restrictions are going to be dialed back a little bit, and then yeah, how long it's going to take to get comfortable actually traveling again. But
that's right.
So we'll see about all that. So how old are your boys then at this point?
Well, Bobby's five and Langston is one.
Okay.
I I'm a little bit older than that. You know, a couple of people said to me, oh, well, that was a late start. And I always borrow from the Kerr clan, the Scottish family Kerr. Their family motto is late, but in earnest.
So you might not be done then.
No, I'm done. And if my wife were here, she'd say the same thing, I'm sure.
Yeah.
They're great boys, full of energy, and they're what life is all about. You know, that sense of fun and family is best seen through the eyes of the young. And the old, as I'm discovering, you know, here in a sense of lockdown at Caledonia Senior Living, our seniors still know how to have fun.
Right. Yeah, no, it's amazing. I've been reconnecting with some folks in the older generation, and it's amazing how much they can recall. And I've lost a little bit of that over the years because of my my grandfather passed away a number of years ago, as did my grandmother, and my father passed, you know, back some about 7 years ago. So it's been good to have some conversations with the older generation and hearing how vibrant some of those stories still are. And again, that's something so impressive about what you guys are doing there in terms of help rekindling some of those memories. So, with that, you know, is there anything else that you want people to know kind of about your organizations and what you have going on there?
Yeah, everything in everyone's life at the moment is about COVID-19. It's impacted us in an incredible way. We have a board meeting tomorrow, and our last board meeting last quarter was just before this crisis really hit. The Illinois Department of Public Health had just come in for their, once every 2 years, they come and survey this community. And they came in and were looking at our operations, our housekeeping, our food service, our environmental services, of course, our nursing and so on. And they gave us a zero deficiencies survey, which means it's the best they could give us, a blank piece of paper upon which was written all of the things they wanted to see by way of improvement. So we were really wanted to thank and congratulate our staff. And we hung a sign up above the front door that said, congratulations on the zero deficiency survey. And then COVID-19 hit and we closed our doors and the world changed for everyone. As we got into this, I realized that there were a few things we needed as a community and as a field in long-term care and senior care that we needed to do. We needed to obtain as much PPE as was needed, personal protective equipment, masks and gowns and gloves and hand sanitizer and thermometers and so on. And there was none around. So we reached into our own board, and I'm so grateful to the chairman of our board, a gentleman named Paul Melville, who helped us through his network, his firm Grant Thornton, find an importer of PPE. And through that connection, I was able to reach out to our neighboring communities here. And we were one of the first to be delivered a whole load of masks and protective equipment. It was a really important thing. But the other thing we needed, as well as PPE, is testing. And I've written to the governor and to the head of IDPH, Dr. Azike, saying we support everything they're doing to obtain as much testing as possible for the people who are working in this field. Because at the end of the day, the best way to protect the health and safety of people living in long-term care is to protect the health and safety of the people working in long-term care. IDPH, about a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, called communities like ours and were able to get us a supply of tests. The tests became more plentiful and more available. And we said to one another as our community here, look, once we test, we must lean into this and really develop an aggressive model of testing, because we know that there is asymptomatic presentation of this virus, and we know that there are false positives in these tests. Therefore, the only way that you can have surety and certainty and not be speculative is to test regularly. So for now 4 weeks, we are into our routine. This is our fourth week of testing everyone on our campus, top to bottom, residents, staff, any agency, any therapy companies that are coming in, everyone is tested. We have really taken some extreme measures to protect everyone living and working here. And I wanted to really know what it felt like to live here. So a week ago, I moved into the campus and I stayed for a week. And it was actually Mother's Day that I moved in to give my wife the best present she could. I cleared off. Okay. No, I still owe her a Mother's Day, and I have a feeling that Father's Day will become Mother's Day in a few weeks. But I really did this to connect with the people who work here, particularly those hours of the day that work night shift, to get to know them, to build a bond with them, and to tell them how much the board and I and senior management really recognize and appreciate their commitment to caring through this crisis. And it's them that have kept this wolf from our door as much as they have. I also wanted to see the world through the eyes of our residents. If you give your attention to a Scotsman for long enough, he will quote Robert Burns. And here it goes, fair warning. Pray the Lord the gift to give us to see ourselves as others see us, said Robert Burns. The greatest gift is to see yourself as others see us. So I wanted to see the organization, the home, the community, and everything related to us through the eyes of the residents. So that was a really important and valuable experience that I had. And all of these things are to say there is nothing that we won't do to protect the people living and working here. I'll stop at nothing. If it means we have to go into lockdown, so be it. If it means we have to test people every week, so be it. But our mission, 175 years old, we're the oldest charity in Illinois. Our mission became different as soon as COVID-19 became part of everyone's lives. Our mission became about protecting lives. And yes, we're ever mindful of the social, emotional, spiritual, and mental well-being of all of our residents. But without physical well-being, those things don't amount to much. So we made it our job to protect them. And as we begin to reopen and restore the community, I know that we will be able to get back to live out the mission as it was defined for all those 175 years. But the only way to ensure tomorrow is to protect today. And that's really what we're all about right now. We'll do it with a smile on our face and our whiskey in our hands, though.
There you are. Yeah. That's, no, again, it's great work that you're doing and being able to really shift your focus and being, as locked in as you need to be successful in this environment. So I know, you know, we all felt like we were busy and fully committed before any of this started. Right. So, and this has shifted all of our priorities, but I guess that's another question I have for you is what does the other side of this look like once we are able to move beyond COVID-19 and we have no idea how long that's going to take, but what does the other side look for you guys? It was my understanding you were in the middle of some fundraising campaign for capital improvements. What does the other side look for you?
I appreciate that question. We have a board meeting tomorrow and we're going to take a look into the future as much as we're able to, Drew. Pre-COVID-19, at the 174th annual Feast of the Haggis, which is the longest running black tie dinner in the city of Chicago, we get together, we break bread, we drink a few good whiskies, we eat haggis, we dance, we wear kilts, etc. But we take a moment to kind of pause and look at the state of the society, the state of the Chicago Scots. And we reported that we had had the best philanthropic year in our history. Two or three, one of whom is requested to remain anonymous, but three incredibly pioneering donors said, there is something special about that community. We want to make sure it continues to look as good as the care we know you provide there. And it had been several years since we had refurbished the oldest parts of the Scottish home. So we were in a project to raise money, and we're pretty close to where we need to be to refurbish the oldest parts of the Scottish home. Now, COVID-19 means that some of those plans, I think, need to be revisited. The front of our community, as I mentioned earlier, the front door has never been locked in all these years. We've had an open door, located as we are in the beautiful forest preserve. We see deer more than we see people here. You know, we're only 7 miles away from downtown Chicago, but we're in the most serene and peaceful setting. But COVID-19 has made us really recognize that the world beyond this point, the world of tomorrow, will require us to take a different approach to security, to screening people as they come in. All of those measures I don't see going away, and certainly not for us if the people we're protecting are the most vulnerable among us. Even when the rest of society opens up and there is a vaccine or whatever is required for Governor Pritzker and the team in Springfield and businesses up and down this beautiful state to fully open. Even beyond that point, I think we need to be precautious. We need to maintain levels of screening. We need to make sure that people are coming into a building observing physical distancing, and that we have the tools, technologies, equipment, supplies that we need to make sure that if anything were to happen in the future, we have built into our planning a rapid retreat into lockdown again. I hope that's not the case, but as I've said to everyone, while I hope for the best, I must plan for the worst. And as we begin to look at reopening and restoring the community, I take the plan that we put together, the plan of lockdown, which incidentally we worked with those communities I mentioned. We were in collaboration and continue to be in collaboration with neighboring communities for whom we secured the PPE. Our partners are King Brewer House in Burr Ridge, Cantata Adult Life Services in Brookfield, Plymouth Place in LaGrange, the Admiral at the Lake in the city of Chicago, and Central Baptist Village in the city of Chicago. Between us, those communities represent nearly 700 years worth of charitable service to Illinois. We employ thousands of people, and we serve thousands of seniors. And it's really with those communities that we developed our plans of lockdown. So now we begin to kind of put these plans into reverse, and we're seeing what it looks like if we can return to communal dining. Can we do it all at once, or do we need, the modelling that they've implemented in the UK and elsewhere, to create bubbles, social bubbles of a limited number of residents and have them return to communal dining on days X, Y, and Z, and then a different group on days A, B, and C. We know that the best looking model for the future is less intense insofar as congregate settings, more in households or a limited number of residents who share friendship or that know one another, particular bond. I think what the future looks like is going to be more like McLean House that I mentioned, based on household models, based on feelings of family and home and love, which is where we started. I hope, and I really hope hard that we get back to the days that we've seen in the days of yore. I fear we're never going to get back there. There will always be a resonance of COVID-19 that we need to guard against.
Yeah, at this point, it certainly feels that way, but hopefully, you know, over time, and it's years, not months, probably before we get there. Yeah. But, you know, the Spanish flu of 1918, it took quite some time, but, you know, eventually, you know, we were able to get back to some normalcy. So we can
hope. I looked through our records. Of course, we've been around since 1845, and the Scottish Home has been around since 1910 here in North Riverside. This home was destroyed by a fire, completely destroyed down to its foundations. It was a pile of ashes and rubble in the year 1917. But here's a story of leadership. There was a guy called John Williamson, who summoned his board to stand over the dying embers of this fire. And he looked each one of them in the eye and he said, "The Scottish home must not die in its own ashes. It must always be a monumental tribute to the best qualities of the Scots." And in 2 weeks, enough money was donated that we could rebuild the home. And in less than 12 months, the residents moved back in, and that was in the year of the Spanish flu. So you go back to the earliest roots of this organization. We've been through two world wars, the Great Chicago Fire, the Great Depression, the Spanish flu. It's going to take more than COVID-19 to take the stuffing out of this organization. And as I said, despite the restrictions, we still find a way to have fun. We still find a way to deliver life's most important things to our residents. And we will get through it. Whether we get through it and back to the days we've been through, hey, my dukes, as they say in Scotland, but we will be better for it. We will be stronger.
Yep. Great. So for people who, audience members who want to learn more, where's the best place to find you guys?
We're online, chicagoscots.org. That's Chicago, SCOTS.org, or CaledoniaSeniorLiving.org. Those are our two websites. Call 708-447-5092. That's obviously our phone number. Come and see us. Once we open up, we want to throw our arms around the world, as they say, even if it's from a safe social distance. We'd love to welcome you to come and visit the campus when it's safe to. We're in North Riverside, just a few miles west of the city, easy to get to from north, south, east, and west. And we'll make sure we offer a warm Scottish welcome to you at Caledonia Senior Living.
There we go. Well, that's great. And then you and I should find some time when the when the world settles down and you, it's not so scary out there. Maybe we can find some time to play a little golf. So
I'd love that, Drew. Yeah. I'd love that, Drew. Yeah. You know, right. You have a Ryder Cup shirt on there. If the European Ryder Cup team want to guarantee victory, I should point out that I was on the 18th green when Monty sank the putt at Oakland Hills. I was also on the 18th green when Martin Keimer sank the putt at Medina. Therefore, at Whistling Straits, if they want to be guaranteed a victory, they ought to install me at the 18th green. I'm now an American, so I'm not sure. They'll be willing to do that. So
there you go. I think the tickets have got. I don't know if you've secured your tickets, and of course we don't know what's going to happen here with. With the event even happening as scheduled, but the seems like they're getting more and more difficult. You know, I also went to Medina and was there that day for the meltdown by the American team.
Yeah.
But we were looking at trying to get some tickets up to Kohler this for this fall, and so far haven't had a lot of luck. So we'll see. It's a tough ticket to get.
It's a tough one. Yeah. I love it, though. The Ryder Cup was such great fun.
It is. Yeah, there's nothing like it in golf. Well, the President's Cup, but it's still not the same. So, all righty. Well, with that, thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed the discussion. And yeah, let's stay in touch.
Thank you, Drew. Appreciate it.
Yep. Take
care. Take care now. Be safe.
You too. Bye-bye.